Hello, everyone. Can everyone hear me? We are now live. I am Susan Johnson, and this is the wonderful Clem Ford. But before I start and do a more fulsome introduction, I thought I would like to do the acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge this land that we meet on today is the traditional lands of the Kaurna people, and that we respect their spiritual relationship with their country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. I was at the opening of the festival at the Adelaide Town Hall, and there was a local Kaurna man who did the Welcome to Country, and he talked about owning his hair, owning his hands, but not owning the land, having a relationship that he belonged to the land. And it was just very moving. So I feel very much that we are on Kaurna land, and I'm very, very honoured to be here today. I would also like to now welcome Clementine to the stage. Clem has written this fabulous book, which you must all line up and buy and get signed by her later today, because this is the last session at the festival and we're ending with the best, and Clem will be very happy to sign books after we end today. But you all know that Clem really burst upon the scene probably about 10 years ago now, possibly not quite 10 years ago, with her first book, Fight Like a Girl, which I think was published in 2016, something like that. She burst like a supernova into public consciousness, really. And we could almost say that Fight Like a Girl heralded her many, many fights for justice in this country, and she's been fighting hard ever since. So please welcome to the stage Clementine Ford.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all so much for such a beautiful, warm welcome. And thank you to Susan as well. Susan and I have been friends for quite a number of... I think even before Fight Like a Girl came out. And it's just always so nice to run into you and to get to spend time with you. It's never enough time. But like Susan, I would also like to acknowledge and honour the lands of the Kaurna people that we are on. I pay my respects to elders past and present. And the older I get, the more... the more open my own soul and spirit is to feeling and acknowledging and understanding what it means to be entity in spirit and the responsibilities that we all have to do right on the earth and to speak up when we need to speak. And I mean, obviously, you'll notice I'm wearing a kefir. I've been very active in the fight for Palestinian freedom. I can't do any of these events without acknowledging that we are watching something devastating occur, and particularly given that tomorrow is International Women's Day. And I think there's probably going to be a lot of very obvious silence around that, but if you can't fight at least for Palestinian women and children, then I think you need to reassess your values. So I hope that everyone will join me in at least fighting for Palestinian kids. It is a real pleasure to be here as well, because I originally am from Adelaide, and I remember 25 years ago beginning my forays to Adelaide Writers Week, and you know, we could never afford to come to the actual event, so we would do what these beautiful people on the left are doing here, and we would sit on the hills, and it just felt so exciting to be a part of something where people were discussing ideas. And you know, I remember meeting Drusilla Modjeska and being so excited to line up and have her autograph my copy of The Orchard. To be here is really, it feels like a full circle moment. And I guess what I'm saying as well is that if any of you in the audience are young and have aspirations to be a writer, or if you're older and have aspirations to never give up, I say something in my show, Love Sermon, if you can see your dreams calling to you, if you can hear your dreams calling to you from the horizon, swim, swim, swim as fast as you can towards them. Someone has to make it. Why not you?
Wonderful. Thank you. And it's interesting that you bring up Drusilla. Drusilla's older than me, but we're pretty much of the same generation, in that I'm the previous feminist generation to you, I'm in the old school of feminists who were marching in Reclaim the Night marches, and I'm sure there's many of you here who... So I was a young woman in the late 70s, and I'd be carrying signs that would say better dead than wed. Does anyone remember that one? So it seems to me
still true.
Still, I mean, in some ways, you know, is it depressing that we're still having the same conversation? I mean, that was, you know, we're talking 30, 40 years ago, so. Haven't we won that kind of notion of marrying? Haven't we already had that debate? Is it depressing the fact that you've still got to write a book now in 2024 where this is still a live issue?
I mean, I think it's really important to remember that the systems that we're fighting against, patriarchy, capitalism, white supremacy, they are deeply entrenched. They're very smart. They have hundreds, if not thousands, of years of experience and time to refine themselves and also how to figure out how to pivot. So whenever, whether or not it's women, whether or not it's you know, people of color, whenever a marginalized group of people decides to rise up and fight against systems of oppression, the system will either try to stamp them out, punish them, as obviously we've seen, you know, even in the last 100 years with feminists, or go, well, we can't do that anymore, so how do we reinvent ourselves? How do we make it more appealing, I guess? And one of the things that I write about in the book is that we also have to look at who is being appealed to. Mm. There is this idea that, and I have some thoughts as well about this idea of like longevity of change that I remind me to get to it. But when people reminisce, when I say people, when conservatives and conservative white male pundits in particular, I'm thinking like Tucker Carlson, potentially Andrew Bolt, I don't know if he's really fixed his eye on marriage, but that kind of like traditionalist, when they fixate on this supposed golden era of marriage, you know, this traditional era that we need to get back to, we need to get back to traditional values, we need to acknowledge and honor women in the home, all these feminists. If you're on TikTok at all, you might have seen the most absurd and illogical conspiracy theory that circulated over the past couple of years, which was that somehow that feminism was invented by the Rockefeller Foundation to get children into government schools so they could be brainwashed there, and to also create jobs for women so that women would become taxpayers and capitalist earners for the government. It's like, so much of that is incorrect and wrong, and also signals your real lack of understanding of exactly how long women's liberation goes back, which is right to the beginning.
Yeah, but there is, that's really interesting, but there is something genius in patriarchy in that that you just mentioned before. It's a bit of a shapeshifter. It will change, so it can subvert things to its own course. Like, for example, with the development of the market economy in China, less and less women are getting married there, less and less women are having children. So the market economy wants to have women in the workforce. It suits them. So patriarchy, it kind of is so closely intertwined with capitalism.
Well, this is the problem is in this nostalgia is that actually, firstly, there's no such thing as the golden era of marriage. Stephanie Kuntz, who is one of the world's preeminent historians on marriage, in her book Marriage: A History, she calls it the long decade because it lasted somewhere between around 1950 to about 1964. But it was a long decade that was also, it had the unique experience of being post-World War II. So there was an economic boom. There was also a need for, you know, white Western culture and society in particular to soothe the masses. You know, the creation of suburbia in America is this idea that somehow, well, the war is over now. And also, conveniently, all of those women who worked during the war and who discovered something of their own independence and who also felt, however I might feel about this, patriotic in their own way, that they were turning up and doing their part for the war effort, suddenly having these returned soldiers, you know, needing to be basically soothed and placated by a government that had kind of fucked them by sending them off to kill and die. really didn't provide them much in the way of pensions with the Returned Servicemen's Bill. You know, yes, you can go to college, yes, you can get a little bit of a pension, but it didn't support anyone. To get all of those women back into the home, there needed to be this establishment of this idea of like, well, we're post-World War II now, and the easiness of life. You get these appliances, yeah. You can go and, you know, the mothers can stay at home, the fathers can go out to work. But which mothers? Which fathers? Because that nostalgic period, the long decade of traditional marriage, the fact that people even call it traditional marriage when it's so recent in history, traditional marriage actually had men and women working together. It was an economic pursuit. You would form a, you would build on your kinship groups, basically. So this idea that it's traditional marriage as opposed to an experimental form of marriage that ultimately failed but doesn't sound as good on Fox News needs to be acknowledged. But also, women of colour never got to stay at home with their kids. You know, the welfare system in America, which was created to service white people initially, and then became this tool for pejorative racism when black women, also black families also started to access it. They didn't care about black women staying at home with their kids and black men going out to work. I mean, in fact, they, even now in America today, that would freak most conservatives out, because women of color, as we know, are the most oppressed people in society, and particularly when poverty is included in that, which it often is based on how the systems work together, all of that labor is needed to allow this freedom of not working, this freedom of movement. So even now when you kind of say, well, isn't feminism about choice? Isn't feminism about being allowed to stay at home? And it's like, well, that's a nice idea. But who gets to stay at home and who has to go out and work? Who has to go out and work in order for, you know, I was saying this to someone the other day, this is slightly separate to marriage, but the success of books like The 4-Hour Work Week. If you just change your mindset and if you just work smarter, not harder, you can work for 4 hours and you can amass, you know, an economic pile of money where you get to be, you get to have movement and traction in the world. The woman who's making clothes in a factory, for, you know, it was so interesting last week when the gender pay gap data came out. And of course it's going to inspire fury to realize that the gender pay gap is still so demonstrable and that women are still suffering economically in the workplace here. But this idea that somehow we need to address the gender pay gap in Suzanne or in City Chic or in Cotton On, and that somehow when white collar women working in corporations in Australia have economic parity with white men working in corporations in Australia, that's it. We've fixed it. We've solved the gender pay gap and we've solved gender oppression. That can only happen if you are still allowing for a system of complete and abject exploitation of women in the global majority.
Absolutely. I don't think you can talk about marriage, the whole subject, without talking about class and race as well.
So can I just say quickly, one of the things that was appealed to with women and that I write about in the book and that I would love for white middle-class women like me especially to reflect on with this, not in a sort of a finger-pointing way, but how we have been co-opted into this system of aspiring to marriage in order to prop up things like patriarchy, capitalism, white supremacy. Because if we as white women see ourselves more as aligned with white men with power and more desirous of like wanting to be protected, wanting to be held under the banner of male authority, under the banner of like the social mobility that you get from being a married woman, even if we want to pretend that we don't still think that there is some kind of social privilege that comes from that, there is. How we have been lured into that to stop us from aligning ourselves with other marginalized groups with whom we would actually have real significant power and to whom we owe our allegiance and our service, because we are that linchpin, that swing vote between how, you know, how white patriarchy is upheld by our allegiance to it and by our aspiration to kind of have success within it, and how black women in this country in particular are significantly harmed by it. Mm. We have to choose a side.
But amazingly, the Australian Bureau of Statistics figures show that more children, for the first time actually since stats were collected, more children in this country were born to parents who weren't married for the first time since stats were collected. I was quite surprised about that because I thought, you know, in popular culture, marriage, it features in, you know, Married at First Sight. The whole notion, something that didn't exist when I was a young woman was, and I speak as someone who's been married twice and divorced twice. Destination marriages. You know, like now young people, when I got married, people getting married in your parents' garden was a thing to do, if you got married at all, because many feminists didn't ever get married. But now you've got this kind of push-pull thing where the whole notion of the destination wedding where you spend like $50,000 to take a group of your friends to I don't know, the Amalfi Coast or something, which strikes me as incredibly obscene, but it's very, very fashionable. So at the same time that marriage seems to be falling off in general, statistically, however, maybe that's, again, you can't leave out the notion of class and race in that. It seems to be this enduring appeal of marriage, you know, all those kinds of in popular culture. And also, and this may be a separate question, given that we've just had gay marriage for gay people, there are many, many gay people who are attracted to the notion of being married. And kind of where does that fit? It seems that I was reading another book for another session on marriage, Devorah Bounds, and she quotes the cisgendered writer Maggie Nelson. I'm not sure if how many of you know Maggie Nelson's work, but she's a wonderful American author. She wanted to marry her partner, who's gender fluid. He's a sculptor. He's called Harry Dodge. Precisely because she said she was attracted to the nuptial contract, which allows a couple to gain entry into the intimate arena of the unpronounced. So for her, it was a kind of a mystical thing. Is there any way that we can change the very nature of marriage so it can become a kind of a more radical experiment in sexuality, in power, in gender, in family, identity? Does it always have to be owned by the far right, the conservative right? Is there another way we can...
Well, my view on that is that we're thinking about it in the wrong way.
Right.
And that is that, firstly, to your first point about, you know, the allure of the destination wedding, the allure of the wedding itself, I think that that's all a function of capitalism. And it's especially a function of social media and competitive social media. You know, I write in the book about proposals, about these elaborate state... I mean, there are people that you can hire if you are crazy and you want to waste your money. There are people you can hire to event plan your proposal. But the purpose of that is so that you can then share your proposal with an audience of people you don't know, or some of whom you may know. So it's this competitive kind of like, well, who is loved the most? Who gets to, you know, I quote a social researcher in there who talks about how her research found that the more objectively successful in the world women are, the more educated they are, the more class privilege they have, the more, the more career success they have, the more likely they are to say, I would like a very traditional proposal. I would like to be proposed to. And she concluded from this that there is something still in women that's, you know, that feels maligned by claiming too much for ourselves, that it needs to be apologized for in the proposal by playing the girl. So everywhere else I'm like, powerful, but where it matters, he still will get down on one knee. And I'm saying he in particular because it is a very heteronormative concept. I think that with, you know, when people are having a destination wedding or going on maths or whatever, I don't think that they're thinking even of the marriage. I would argue actually that a lot of people have a wedding not thinking about the marriage. And the reason I would argue that is because the wedding is a performance, but also because so many people say, well, we only got married because I wanted to have a party. Well, did you have to sign a government contract to have a party? Something about the contract appeals to you too. And in part, it's because there are tangible, particularly in America where you can't, you know, the writer Gia Tolentino, in her collection of essays, Trick Mirror, she wrote about only getting married because it was the only way that she and her long-term partner could have it could enjoy each other's health insurance. And in a country like that, health insurance is obviously paramount. So all of these little things that the government does in, by way of tax breaks, by way of you know, family tax benefits, you don't necessarily need to be married to have those, but the codification of it all, I come back to why? Because yes, it's cynical, but I don't remember the government ever specifically caring about whether or not people were genuinely happy. What they care about is whether or not people are compliant and whether or not people are conforming to, whether or not you're Labor or Liberal, conforming to what is perceived to be traditional values. And if you are married, it's harder to leave a relationship for a start. And if you, and Yumi Stein says that part of what makes it harder is that it's this sort of like, it's not even the legislative contract, although that is hard and it's more expensive, but it's this sort of magic that's weaved around, oh, well, you got married and then you're divorced, so you're a failure in some way. You failed, you know, a failed marriage. I always think no relationship is a failure because it teaches us something. And particularly if you have children, how can you say, even if divorce happens, this is a failed relationship when you've produced life from it and presumably life that you love? Yep. So, you know, this idea that somehow people just want to have a party. So they spend, on average in Australia, it's $35,000. They spend $35,000 on this party, which also attracts the wedding tax, because if it's for a wedding, then vendors charge more. When they could just have a party. Yeah. They could just have a party in the backyard, but that doesn't give you the performance of it to your friends and family and to the outside watching world. It also doesn't give you the knowledge that you are married. Whatever you might pretend you think about that, that somehow, and I disagree with Maggie Nelson that there's something mystical about it, because I think that there is something mystical about the idea that you would fall in love with someone and commit to them for the rest of your life. And that actually has nothing to do with signing a piece of paper, because prior to the church deciding that they would be in control of the, you know, the legalization of marriage, deciding that they would be the ones who put the bans on the door and announced who got to be married at all, that's like 1400 AD.
Yeah.
Every marriage before that marriage was overseen by people's families and communities. You know, the pagan tradition of ribbon tying. None of that required you to report your relationship to the government. So I think that, you know, bell hooks writes in Communion about, particularly with women, that we that generally speaking, we have a desire to be loved and we want to give love, and there's nothing shameful about that. But part of the way that patriarchy inflicts that, inflicts punishment for that on women, is by indoctrinating us from the very beginning to believe that we were not born worthy of love, that we have to prove ourselves worthy of love by, you know, by conforming to patriarchal ideas. And one of the first and most obvious ways that you conform to patriarchal ideas is pretending that patriarchy is good for you, pretending that you're not a threat to it. And so marriage and all of this, you know, when people say, well, what do you think about same-sex marriage? Don't you think that that's radical? I say, no, that's same-sex couples being cleverly lured into a conservative tradition that props up conservative ideals. Because as well, if a government says, well, we have individual silos of people, a household here that's maybe four or five people, a household here. And by the way, as Elizabeth Gilbert says, in sort of cis-normative couples, the woman, as we know, will do the bulk of the unpaid care work, the unpaid mental load. I mean, that's, we don't even need to like prove that. We just know that that is true from data. But she also takes on all of the work that a government is responsible for otherwise doing to protect its citizens. The healthcare work, the you know, making sure that the citizens are eating good food, like healthy food, drinking water, going to school, keeping clean, all of that stuff is suddenly done by the woman. So it saves the government a lot of money. So it's deeply important to the government that they have women doing all of that unpaid labor so they can pork barrel in rich electorates, or they can send money to the police or to the military or whatever it might be. And secondly, it allows them to say, well, this is a nation of family values. And this is a nation of people who care about their families. And that's why we need to institute this very conservative policy. One of the reasons why witches in the Middle Ages, and I write a lot about witches and the witch trials of Europe in this book, one of the reasons why witches were pursued, one of the reasons why witches were pursued was because they were the healers. They were the wise women. They were the cunning folk. And they weren't like charging people for that. You know, it was just like the witch down by the swamp handing out some herbs. At the time, the peasantry was at risk of rising up against the aristocracy. A peasantry that has numbers to protest its oppression and exploitation at the hands of the ruling class is very clearly, as we've seen consistently, as we're still seeing now today, very dangerous for the ruling class. And the women who were providing healing services to the peasantry were not, and they were obviously of the peasantry themselves, they were not only keeping people alive, but they were reminding people who had been told, you are the serfs, you owe this to the king, they were reminding them that they had value, that they deserved to be cared for, that they deserved healthcare. And it wasn't, I don't think necessarily, although Silvia Federici writes about this in Caliban and the Witch, it wasn't necessarily amongst all people this very like conscious political action, but it had the impulse, the impact of making, at its heart, reminding people of the power of community. So if you think about marriage, I know you're trying to get in with the question, I just want to like get this thought out. If you think about marriage as being in service to a, whether it's the aristocracy or whether it's a government, however the ruling class asserts itself, in service to essentially the need to destroy community, to destroy a mass of people rising up together and saying, we will all take care of each other. It doesn't matter if this person's married or not married. We will make sure that she and her children are looked after. It doesn't matter if this person has no interest in it. It doesn't matter if these people are gay, whatever. We live as a community of people. And it's a very, I understand that that's not across the board. I think it's a particularly white expression of community, but also power and white supremacy and capitalism is a particularly white thing. I think that marriage and our impulse to do it is very clearly designed in a modern world to prevent community activism and prevent people from seeing power in numbers.
Well, I mean, you've just... yes, I think that's... Thank you.
Thank you.
You just answered several questions that I was going to ask you in that.
Sorry, I just tend to do that.
No. But it really, this book is full of great aphorisms. Clem is really, really good at just concentrating something, even though she's, you know, eloquent here and is talking a lot. There will be a whole lot of...
Emphasis on a lot there, Susan.
No, there's a whole lot of little wonderful one-liners in this book, which I just took great joy in. And in fact,
News Limited will never tell you how funny I am.
No, well, that's right. That is absolutely true. So she's got this great line here, if you don't mind me reading it out. It says, it is a truth universally acknowledged that a single woman in possession of great freedom must be celebrated and revered. Why don't we think about rewriting the marriage plot in a different way? We're not going to hear that, are we? This is what Clem is saying. In truth,
I think the next bit of that line was "ha ha, just joking."
Yeah. The next bit is "ha ha." Yeah. That's right, because you don't hear that. What we hear is the marriage plot over again and again and again, and being reinvented even in popular culture still in 2024. But in truth, you say what is actually said is that single woman is gross, ugly, and she must be destroyed before she infects other women with the disease of independent thought. Mm. My question was, why are disruptive women punished? But I think you've kind of answered that in your...
Well, but also it's really interesting for us to reflect on as well how dumb the patriarchy wants to believe all women are, and how we're so silly. We're just self-saboteurs. We get a whiff of some single woman being free and we think that will make us happy. And we're actually just standing in our own way because we need men to tell us what will make us happy. And we always have done every single time they've changed the rules on what will make us happy. You know, the interesting thing that I discovered while writing this book as well is that, and you'll hear a lot of young male podcasters, I know, horrifying thought. You'll hear a lot of young male podcasters just prosecuting this argument all over the internet with absolutely no... I mean, one of the things that offends me the most about them, I think, is not just what they say and how incorrect it is, but there is absolutely no curiosity to even go and read a single book by anyone, let alone a woman, that would give them tangible data to back up what they're saying. It's enough for them just to feel that it's true. And every woman here will have had an experience with at least one man who needs to explain her situation to her in a way that she might finally understand. You know, you could scream until you're black and blue, you know, I'm very happy being a single woman, or I'm very happy being child-free, or whatever it might be, I'm very happy being separated. And you'll invariably find at least one man at the pub named Dave who'll tell you that you're wrong. And you don't know. And the problem is that you're listening to women like that Clementine Ford. She's brainwashing you. She's brainwashing you. The number of women who've contacted me to say, you know, in the post-separation period, to say that their husbands or their partners used to ridicule them for reading my work, and used to say that I was the problem. You just broke up with me because of that woman. Like, they can't possibly think for themselves. You know, they couldn't possibly come to that conclusion for them by themselves. Now, the interesting thing about all that is that this idea that somehow women are naturally more nurturing, that we're the natural caregivers, there's something moral and correct about us wanting to become mothers and devote ourselves to that work, is a really good example of that pivot and that reinvention. Mm-hmm. It's so historically new. Prior to around the 18th century, in England especially, very, very quick history lesson, and don't worry, you can read all about it in the book, but very quick history lesson is that when, in the post-industrial revolution period, where suddenly the work that was done by couples and by married couples and by families in the home, where the home was a space of domestic labor and also economic growth. So it wasn't this kind of, you went to work and then you came home and home was not work. It was all of those things together, and men and women worked together. You would in fact marry someone who could help you build that economic capital, which makes sense, you know. Post the Industrial Revolution, when people began going out to work and where factories, well, firstly you would have this establishment of a middle class, where a middle management type person would suddenly be able to make money off of the labor of workers and factory work. Which as well, just quick side note, when people sort of reminisce about this nostalgic period of, you know, the golden era of the 1950s and letting kids be kids, now let kids be kids. Do you know how many children were forced to go out to work and like sent down the mines and worked in factories because they were part of the working poor? So when this separation was made, and suddenly women could somehow use their capital too, because they might have inherited some money. And if they married, the law of coverture, which was in place officially for a few centuries, you know, in the mid sort of last millennia, and then unofficially is still in place today. Coverture, in the French translation, is la femme couverte, which is the covered woman. And it was that as a woman, your identity was essentially covered by your father and then your husband. It was absorbed into his. You didn't have an identity of your own. So if you married and you had any inheritance, your inheritance would automatically go to your husband. It was one of the reasons why the Bennet girls in Pride and Prejudice were so fucked, because they didn't have a male heir to essentially keep them under the banner of his authority. They had nothing, so they needed to marry wealthy men. So the covered woman is still unofficially in place today. Anytime if you're married, anytime the bank has sent you a letter addressed to Mr. and Mrs., even if you don't have the same last name, that's a legacy of coverture. Anytime you might be talking to, this is anecdotal, but anytime you might be talking to a tradesperson as a woman on the phone, and he might say, well, have you checked with your husband, love? You know, whatever it is, there is this assumption that when women marry men, they are under the banner of his authority. You know, white women in America voting for Trump because that was what their husbands wanted them to do. And oftentimes because they support Trump too, but this idea that somehow he tells me what to do. So prior to, you know, the Victorian period in England, they didn't give a fuck whether or not women cared or liked being mothers. Like, that wasn't the point, you know. No one said, well, this is your moral job to do this. This is what will make you happy. The only reason that argument took hold was because post the Industrial Revolution, with this establishment of the middle class and a sort of a political agitation that serviced a very small group of women, which was the wealthy middle class white women who, by the way, during the expansion of the British Empire, their choice to not marry and to not have children was a big problem for a British army that needed bodies on ships. So with this agitation to, you know, get political rights, to get suffrage. Also, you know, any woman who was able to, in this new period of industrial action, make her own money and be acknowledged as a businesswoman was suddenly now appearing on the civil records that had begun to be kept. And that's again a big problem, because if you have women appearing on civil records, it shows that women have political and economic power, which paves the way for maybe them to have the vote. Women were also agitating to be allowed the right to education. I mentioned the witches before. When witches were, with the period of time that really pursued mostly women as witches in Europe was around 500 years, but the heaviest period was 150 years. 150 years of dogmatic pursuit, lies, abuse, and violence, and you know, executions. Most of those women were women over the age of 40, and they were midwives and healers. The church wanted to get women out of the midwifery role because, you know, it publicly said, well, a lot of babies die in childbirth, and that could possibly have nothing to do with the Middle Ages being very bad when it comes to sanitation, but definitely because women are giving those babies to Satan. And we know that women are shapeshifters. We know that women are duplicitous. The same things that we see playing out now when it comes to women being accused of lying constantly to like damage men's lives. All of that came from the witch period. You know, there was it was widely accepted that one of the things that women who were witches did was steal men's penises and hide them in trees. There's a medieval drawing of it that you can look up that appeared in the, the Malleus Maleficarum. I'm wrapping up, Susan, I promise. Okay. I just get really passionate about
because
history.
Because I want to give the floor, because I'm sure some of you, there'll be questions for Clem. We want to have question time. Is there a feeling that you want to ask questions? Yes? Okay. We'll have
I will just wrap this up quickly to give you the argument against Dave at the pub, to sort of fast track all of that. The reason that women now are spoken of as being naturally more nurturing is because when science decided that, when men in the Victorian period decided that science wasn't the enemy, that science was actually, you know, you could be a man of God and you could be a man of science, and that being a man of science also kind of meant that you were God because you could decide what was real and what wasn't. In order to prevent women agitating for all of these rights, scientists decided that we're going to prove that women are intellectually inferior to men. They also did this at the same time as trying to prove that white people were intellectually superior to people of color. So it was a very, like, it was a whole mess of racism and sexism. Every theory that these scientists came up with, which would definitively prove that, yes, women were intellectually inferior to men, ended up targeting at least one of their, like, senior scientists that was like, oh, well, actually, my brain circumference is kind of not very well represented in this theory. So obviously the theory's wrong. Go back to the drawing board. Because you can't prove that because it's not true, what's the next genius reinvention? You turn it into a moral thing, something that can't be disproven, which is that it's not that women are necessarily intellectually inferior to men. It's that our brains are different. And we've been hearing this for at least 250 years, and any neuroscientist worth their salt will say that there's not really any evidence in that at all. But our brains are different, and women need to nurture. That's what makes us happy. And the argument that they use to prevent women from reading too much, from getting too much of an education, from agitating for their rights to mobility in the world, to the same freedoms that men had, was too much education could damage your fertility. Mm. It will throw you off kilter. Which was an argument that went back to, you know, Aristotle and Hippocrates and this idea of the womb as the wandering monster that disrupted women.
Also the notion that if you were a woman and you were over the age of 30, I think it was Time magazine that came up with it, you had more chance of being killed by a terrorist than getting married.
I think Nora Ephron came up with that, maybe.
No. It was actually...
It was actually
Time magazine came up with it, that you know, you better get married, girls, and have babies, because otherwise something awful will happen.
I'll just say before we go to questions very quickly that in all of those stories, and with this idea of the traditional marriage too, we have been told repeatedly, and this is not just women, this is men, this is people, we've been told repeatedly by systems that need us to stay in allegiance to them, this is what normal people do.
Yep.
This is what you need to be happy. And if you look even a little bit, like, and if you buy this book and read it, you'll see that there is a lot of hopefully very digestible history in it. But the ways in which we've essentially been lied to that keep us from the one thing that will actually make us happy, which is community, is something we all need to unlearn in ourselves.
I want to, I had lots of other questions, but I think you've answered a lot of them. But I want to now pivot to an absolutely personal question. And that two great quotes that Clem has in the book. One is, patriarchal culture has been extremely successful in conditioning women to crave its approval. And the other one is a very bold statement, I will not be the mirror that reflects men back to themselves at 10 times their size.
To be clear to anyone picking up on that, I was quoting Virginia Woolf. I didn't steal that.
I want to know how you, Clem, personally, got the power to not crave patriarchal culture's approval. Tell us your secret. That is my question to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that my parents did very poorly was to raise me, like so many of us were, to really strongly fear size. You know, like a lot of my body image and disordered kind of eating, I can relate straight back to my parents. But one of the things that they did really well was to not reinforce this idea of like the most important thing is a husband. You know, my dad always said, for whatever my relationship with him is now, which is essentially non-existent, he always said, never rely on a man, you know, always make your own money. It was never spoken of in my house that the only goal I could aspire to was to be chosen by a man, even though they were also very conscious of the male gaze. And I think that that's true for a lot of women, is that, you know, I can say now, I genuinely do not give a fuck what men think of me. If they don't find me attractive, if they don't like me, if they find me like abrasive, I don't care. In fact, I'll often enjoy it if they don't like it, you know?
How unusual is that, ladies?
But
I speak for myself.
But I do, like all of us, exist under the panopticon of power. And I know myself to be seen by that. And I've tried to figure out what is it that makes me not care about what men actually think about me, but still also feel like I am constantly looking at myself through this. And I think it comes back to what bell hooks writes about, this idea that you need to be worthy of love, and love as we confuse it was, you need to be worthy of being seen. Like, so many people confuse love with just being liked, just being, you know, as Barnaby Joyce said, you'll do, like this sort of a position of service, when actually I feel like true love for anyone, whether it's love with, you know, someone you go to bed with, love for a child, for a parent, for a friend, it's love for yourself, it's a willingness to see them and to witness them and to be remembered. So if we as women are taught that the only way we can find that kind of love is to play this role. I mentioned the two different lessons from my parents because when I talked about that with a friend, she said, it's interesting that your parents reinforced the lesson of physicality at home and that stuck with you. But they didn't reinforce the lesson of needing to marry and find that was your path to worthiness. And that was something you were able to like get rid of, which I think speaks to why it's so important for us to really challenge these. You know, we can't do much about what culture will insist is the truth, but if the home that we are raising children in especially is one that constantly challenges them to question and reminds them inherently of their worth and their right to be full, whole people in the world, to go out and be, you know, to use kind of like modern parlance, to be the main character, to not just be some side character in some man's life. I think that I just bypassed that. Like, there's never been any part of me that, I mean, I like all people, want love and connection, and I've definitely had heartbreaks, you know, when I've fallen in love with people, when I've had my heart broken. But to me, that is totally different to this idea that my worth would come from being picked. And I feel like to have bypassed that and to be able to sit here and say, I truly think that I am able to live. And look, there is an enormous, like, lots of layers of privilege that allow me to do this as well. I can speak more freely than so many other people because I'm not going to be probably beaten up by the cops, you know. I acknowledge that. But in a truly equal world, everyone would be able to feel like their existence and their right to exist and their right to carve a life for themselves and to not have to qualify their right to do that didn't depend on who they attached themselves to. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like one of the reasons why men, generally speaking, need marriage so much is because women sign on to do that work, not just of caring for them, but also of loving them. And men have been fucked by patriarchy by also being separated from their... Mm. It's not that men are necessarily taught to aspire to marriage. It's that men are taught to aspire away from themselves, yeah, to aspire away from love.
Emotional responsibility, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're going to open up to the floor now, but just a reminder that Adelaide Writers Week has a zero tolerance to racism and any disrespectful language. So if you are asking a question, please be civil, please be respectful, and ask away. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just wave your hand or...
No, it's...
Oh, right, sorry. Sorry.
Thank you.
Yep. Got my glasses on.
Yeah.
Rightly or wrongly, I'm considered wealthy, white, middle-class woman. And I have just celebrated 2 months ago 50 years of marriage with all the panoply of difficulties in it. I'd like to ask you what you actually hold sacred in your life.
I think that's a great question. And I would also say that although a 50-year-long relationship is not something I aspire to for myself, when I talk about marriage, my critique is not of love. If you found someone that you wanted to spend 50 years with and that you feel genuinely seen by that relationship and you feel like it's been a worthwhile pursuit in your life, I think that's amazing. I think everyone should be able to pursue the things that give them emotional satisfaction. I dislike that in this world, all you would need to say to people is, we've just celebrated 50 years of marriage, and people would go, amazing, congratulations, and there's no peeling back of whether or not you, because we know that laws have changed over the years, 50 years ago, you were marrying perhaps in a time when you weren't allowed to have your own bank account. So a lot of women have been married for 50 years and have not been happy in it. I don't like the idea that somehow longevity is in and of itself the marker of success or even sacredness. And I also don't like the thought that a woman who had spent 50 years amassing a number of lovers or having no lovers but loving herself, that somehow she's had a bereft life. What I hold sacred, for me personally, the relationship that I have with my child is, and I don't think that, you know, to reiterate, I don't buy this idea that, like, well, women need to have a baby in order to know what real love is. For me personally, it has been one of the most profound loves of my life. And I hold sacred my responsibility, I think, on earth and in life to do right, to stand up and be brave, to speak courageously, even when it's hard, even when a lot of people hate me for it. And I hold sacred the responsibility that I have to my ancestresses, especially, to be able to live the life that many of them were unable to because of laws, because of circumstance, because of history, the incredible women who exist not just in my line, but who count in the infinite throughout history, who have been just walking through life because everything that they wanted to do was kept from them, who weren't able to experience what it meant to be in life. I think that life is a gift, and I have my own spiritual beliefs, and I think that we... For me, the pursuit of knowledge is so paramount to my experience of being a human. And when I talk about that sacredness of my responsibility to my ancestresses, it's that I have an opportunity to do things that they didn't do, and I want to challenge them to do it. Earlier on, we talked about longevity. I read tarot cards, and I'm going to do a reading for Susan after this, but one of the cards in the tarot, for anyone who does tarot will know this, one of the cards is the Three of Pentacles. And the Three of the Pentacles is the suit of foundation. It's like growth in the world. And three is collaboration. The Three of Pentacles in the original Rider-Waite-Smith deck portrayed three people in a cathedral discussing plans. And it's sort of like the simplistic reading is that this is collaboration. You're going to do a project with people. But actually the overriding perception of that was that the time period that these cards are referring to is one in which a cathedral would be built by religious people to honor God, to honor their spirit, to honor their faith. And you couldn't build a cathedral in a year, 500 years maybe to build a cathedral. The people who started building the cathedral, who laid the very first brick, did it knowing that they would never be around to see the end of the building. But they did it knowing that what they were doing was a collective effort to offer thanks to God. The people at the end of it, who laid the very last brick, were able to do that, hopefully acknowledging and honoring the hundreds of years before them of people who worked collectively together. So my point with that is that I see that as being this idea, you know, there's the saying that we're planting seeds for a forest we may never get to sit in. So one of the things that I consider sacred to me is being part of a lineage of people, whether or not related to me or not, but a lineage of people who are always looking for how we can make this world better for others. To me, marriage is sort of not really the goal, because I see it as being so much more love and the expression of love and how we love in the world. I want for me to be so much more than just, well, this is my partner and these are my children and these are the people that I've been called to protect. But I really hope that those 50 years have been incredibly happy for you, genuinely.
I wonder what you think that in this day and age, if you've been in a relationship for 2 years, it can be declared a de facto marriage without you even signing a contract, but you've got all the implications of a contract.
Well, having been in a de facto relationship, listen, I just think that it's crazy that we are at all okay with the government having any kind of say on our relationships, who we sleep with, who we form families with. I do understand that from a practical legal perspective, we need to have protections in place for people. But that's not a function of the government. That's a function of challenging oppression and patriarchy. Again, like if we actually, maybe it's sort of Pollyanna of me, but I think that we should have Pollyannas in the world. We should have pie-eyed kind of, you know, idealism, that a truly collective community wouldn't allow for one member of a family, usually, let's be honest, a woman, to be economically disenfranchised by the breakdown of a relationship. One of my huge problems with this pretense that we have that we care about mothers and that women have to do this, they have to do this in order to be happy, but also this is the most important thing that a job can, most important job that a woman can do, is that it's not actually backed up by the support of a woman. One of the things I find so offensive about history and this, again, this pretense of like loving children and loving mothers is that, you know, until pretty recently, you could declare a child illegitimate if they were born outside of marriage. And as an illegitimate child, they would have no rights to inherit property. They would be considered scum in the eyes of society. They would be treated like dirt, and of course the mother is always treated like dirt anyway. I think that to declare any human in the world illegitimate is disgraceful for a start, but to declare children, to have it to be okay historically that one of the reasons why women needed to be married was because otherwise their children would be seen as garbage in the world, is something that still persists today in that idea of the legacy. We can pretend all we like in this country that we care about women and children. But, you know, I mean, firstly, the silence on foreign conflicts indicates that that's wrong. But also in this country, single mothers, in the majority, live below the poverty line. Children of single mothers are not supported. And when women, and look at America where they're rolling back reproductive health care rights, the idea that somehow single mothers deserve, and not just should be out of the kindness of our hearts, but deserve to be economically supported in order to allow them to do the incredibly important job of raising humans, which, by the way, will become the next generation's taxpayers if you want to just think of it in economic terms purely, is absolutely disgraceful. And it just reinforces this class system. It also prevents women who are otherwise just unhappy or potentially being abused from leaving relationships that, especially in a crisis of living, an economic crisis that we're in now, it's the choice between them and their children living in poverty or staying in a relationship that is violent. We should all be ashamed that we live in a country that makes women choose between those two things instead of actually being supported. No questions.
I think we've only got time for one very short question and one very short answer. So, okay, so...
I love to talk. You know, when you untether yourself from needing male approval, you just speak as much as you like.
Thank you, Clem. You've spoken very wonderfully about the injustice within the institution of marriage. And I'd like to ask you about the injustices in the institution of motherhood. Mm. In a modern, capitalist, patriarchal, and ongoingly colonial world, women are not empowered to become mothers without it being heavily at the expense of their health and their finances and their body. Mm-hmm. Would you invite us to, in the same way of rejecting institution of marriage, to defy the institution of motherhood, or do you think it can still be repaired?
I think that the institution of motherhood, much more so than marriage, is vital to be repaired if we want to survive as a species. Now, I am actually not of the view that we deserve to survive as a species as a rule. I don't think if we died out, I don't think, oh my God, no, what will happen to Earth? Like... I just feel like it's actually fine. But I think that marriage is very different from motherhood, but the two have been conflated in a way that really troubles me, and I will be quick, I promise. But I don't like that a thing that I can do with my body, that I might, that I'm also being told constantly you need to do in order to be happy, is then somehow automatically linked with and praised or discredited on the basis of how I do that. You know, even economically well looked after women who are deciding now, you know, Alexandra Collier's book Inconceivable is a great one. But to choose to be a sole mother in a country you need to have, in a country like Australia even, you need to have an extraordinary amount of economic power. Mm. Even that is seen as being somehow selfish. Selfish that you're doing this outside of children need a father. It's like children need people in their life who love them. And children need influences from all areas from people who love them. They don't need to see mum and dad playing out horrendous gender, you know, restrictive gender roles in order to somehow like be a valid person in the world. And I object to the idea that if I were to say, well, I want to climb to base camp at Mount Everest, I would never be like, I better find a boyfriend first. Like, if this is a thing that my body can do, and it did do, and it suffered for it, and the question of, like, economic support goes in with my previous answer, then why can't I be in control of it? Why can't I be allowed to do it as an expression of my physical capacity without having to moralize it or connect it to essentially a system that I need to be starry-eyed about in order to protect and prop up a government that ultimately does not want to place my healthcare, my body security, my economic security, and my child's welfare anywhere near the top of its list.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Sorry I stressed you out, Susan.
We don't have time for any more questions. I'm sorry. Would everyone please join me in thanking the amazing Clementine Ford, who will be over there signing books. You can talk to her now. And
thank you all. And thank you as well to Susan Johnson and to the Adelaide Writers Week and to the amazing
and
Louise Adler.